Today's show is brought to you by Bob's Red Mill, sharing nothing but the best in whole grain nutrition and committed to their mission of good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Dustin Wilson, master sommelier and proprietor of Verve Wine in New York City. We'll talk about wines, restaurants, retail, the movies, and a lot of other stuff. We'll taste a 2012 Umbrian Chardonnay blend from Italy for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Benrubi. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. It's not often we have a master sommelier, movie star, educator, importer, distributor, winemaker, and retailer visit us, let alone one person. Dustin Wilson has his hand in all of that, and we're going to talk to him about it. But currently, he's trying to change the way you buy wine, and we'll get into that, too. Welcome to the show, Dustin.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you here on the Grape Nation. All right, I usually want to get my guest oriented with my listeners oriented with the guests. So I want you to tell us a little about your journey in life in wine that got you to where you are currently, which is Verve Wine in New York City.
Sure.
So bring me all the
way
back
all the way
to
back.
Baltimore.
Way back.
Yeah.
Cool. So, I mean, I guess I should preface it by saying I didn't grow up in a wine family at all. The extent of my wine drinking, prior to falling in love with it, I guess, was I had a few sips on my mom's Franzia White Zinfandel out of the fridge, back in the day. So I guess you could say, wine was not around when I was younger, so it wasn't like a thing that I was kind of brought into, at least not in that world. So I came to wine via restaurants, and I worked in restaurants ever since I could start working, starting off with a job at a sub shop near my house, making cheesesteaks, flipping burgers, that kind of thing when I was like 14, 15 years old. And stayed in that field for a while, just through school, and waited tables. Pretty much did everything. Waited tables, worked in the back of the house, washed dishes, busboy, bartender. You name it. Did pretty much everything in a restaurant capacity. And I think maybe it was my experience doing all those different things back then that kind of led me to want to do lots of different things in the wine world eventually. That together right now.
You wouldn't keep going if you didn't like it.
Right. But I guess back then I really enjoyed the, knowing all the various aspects of a restaurant. So now, I guess, putting in perspective, it's nice to know these various aspects of the wine world. But
Well, you're not the first guest we've had that is a very wine-driven guest, but also makes the case that hospitality and the whole restaurant thing is equally as important.
It's totally important.
And you came up that way.
Correct.
You haven't even told us when you got into wine yet.
Yeah, and the hospitality thing, I'm sure we'll touch on that more later, but I think that drives so much of everything, really. I think
true.
Any business that's interacting with people should and have some sort of hospitality driver involved.
So when was that moment that you realized wine was a happening thing?
Yeah. So it was when I was working at a steakhouse in Maryland, where I grew up in Baltimore.
Was it a steakhouse or a famous one?
Ruth's Chris Steakhouse.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So it's pretty well-known place.
Yeah. I remember getting the job there, and at the time I knew nothing about wine, and you know, I didn't realize I was going to get into wine at all, but I just wanted to work there because it was a somewhat nice restaurant and it had a reputation of being higher end in Baltimore. And at this point in time too, I knew nothing of restaurants really, other than these guys did a good job. People dressed up and went there and spent a lot of money, and you know, you could make good tips. So,
and they always had a good steakhouse wine list.
Right,
probably
exactly.
A lot of California.
A lot of California Cab, a lot of Bordeaux,
right.
A lot of your kind of bigger brand California wines for sure.
Parker wines.
Correct. Right. You know, this was late 90s.
So what happens? You start tasting stuff there?
Well, you know, there was no sommeliers on the floor. I was a server, so you had to kind of get to know the wine list to a certain extent. It was a 400, 500 selection list.
Wow.
And I knew nothing, so I had to figure it out a little bit. So I would speak with some of the more senior servers there, and they did a couple tastings for me. And then from there, it turned into buying wine on my spare time and getting some books and reading about it. Wine for Dummies was my first book.
Worked.
It worked.
It worked. We'll get in later why it worked. But when you were drinking and tasting wine, you realized this is some pretty cool stuff.
Yeah.
This is interesting.
It was really interesting because I just thought like Chardonnay was Chardonnay, and I didn't really understand why some bottles on the list were $50 and others were $3,000. You know, it didn't make any sense to me. So I found it to be fascinating. And then the more I dug into it, the more I realized I had no idea, and it just became almost like an obsession for a while.
So how long was that, your tenure at that steakhouse?
The steakhouse, I think I was there for about 3 years. Almost 3 years, yeah.
So by the time you left, you were self-taught, tasted through
reminded the perspective that I had was that, you know, big Napa steakhouse wines, this was the epitome of wine drinking.
It was the time, the place, and the type
totally,
of restaurant,
yeah.
Too.
So it was, I was all about Opus One and Schaefer and like these wines that, you know, they're good wines. They
Jordan was a big steakhouse.
Jordan, we crushed some Jordan.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
That's
Mondavi for days, right. You know, that kind of stuff. So, you know, I thought I knew a little bit, you know, and I wouldn't say I was cocky, but I was like, all right, I got this thing. I kind of
so
get
you're
it.
You're ready to move.
And yeah, so this was right around the same time I was planning to move to Colorado, and the reason I wanted to move to Colorado is because I like to ski, and I wanted to live out there for a little bit of time, spend a year or two, and just kind of goof off, ski
so
as much as possible.
So you would build what you were going to do around the skiing.
Correct.
Not a career and I'll ski on the side.
Correct.
I'll ski
this was
and then
supposed to be just like a, you know, I guess younger people now would call it a
around.
Gap year. Or
a gap
two.
Year. Okay. I think a gap
there wasn't really a name for
honestly,
it.
Honestly, I
me.
Think a gap year sounds a little more thought out than your plan.
Yeah.
Okay.
This was like, I like to ski. I'm young. I want to just go ski for a while and goof off. And
you knew Colorado.
I wanted to go to Colorado.
Was the wine thing in your mind? Like maybe I could do some wine
originally
stuff there?
It wasn't until I started getting into it at the steakhouse. And then when it came time to move, I was like, you know, it'd be cool to keep going with this wine thing.
Right.
And actually, before I moved out there, I'd gotten to the point with wine where I liked it enough. I started taking a wine course up in Philadelphia at the restaurant school Walnut Hill. It was through the International Sommelier Guild. And it was a great kind of introductory course. Anyway, so when I moved out to Colorado, I landed in Boulder is where I was living and looking for a job. And
Great town. My oldest son, Benjamin, graduated from there.
It's one of my absolute favorite places on the planet.
He skied 80 times a semester.
Yeah, yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, I don't know why I
So you get to Boulder, and I think this is going to lead to the obvious place.
Yeah, so, well, I got there, and I didn't really have a frame of reference for restaurants. I wasn't like a foodie type. I wasn't a restaurant guy. I didn't grow up in that world. So I didn't really know where to look. I just knew I wanted a job at a restaurant that preferably was dinner focused, so I could be there in the evening and ski during the day, and that had a nice wine list. Those are my two kind of prerequisites for a job. And as I was looking around town and checking places out, doing some research onto, you know, the what restaurants were good, somebody recommended Frasca Food and Wine.
Bingo.
There it is. And I said, okay, well, I'll go check it out. And I went in. I think I was wearing like a t-shirt and like a pair of cargo shorts or something, flip flops. And
yeah, but Bobby's like a cyclist in a marathon.
And it is Boulder, you know, yeah. It's Boulder, so it's fine. And I just walked in, and all I wanted to do was I just wanted to peek at the wine list. That's all. And that was going to be my litmus test. You know, if this place has a good wine list, then, you know, maybe I'll consider applying.
A clean shirt on.
Exactly.
Right.
So I walk in and I ask to see the wine list, and they hand it to me, and I'm looking through. And as you know, Frasca is a restaurant that focuses on the cuisine of Friuli, Italy,
right?
Very northeastern Italy. And their list was predominantly Italian and mostly weird Italian stuff. And, you know, coming from a steakhouse background, my world was California. So I look at this list. I'm like, what are these wines? Like, didn't recognize anything at all. Like, weird names, weird grapes, weird regions, nothing. And I didn't see a lot of like super expensive stuff. This was early in the Frasca days. This was, I think they were about a year into their opening. Anyhow, so I'm flipping through the list and I'm getting somewhat discouraged, actually. And then Bobby comes over and asks if I was going to be dining that night. And I said, no, you know, I've just moved to town. I'm looking around for a job and, you know, I like wine. So I kind of want to learn about wine. And he's like, all right, cool. Well, you know, here's my business card. If you decide that you want to, you know, apply here, feel free to reach out.
Such a good guy.
Such a good guy. Yeah. I mean, always such a good guy. To this day. Always the same. Such a hospitality
Bobby
guy.
Bobby is Bobby Stuckey.
He
owns
legend.
Frasca in Boulder, and he is a legendary restaurateur and wine guy. A mentor to a lot of people.
Legend, mentor. I don't know too many guys.
So what happened?
Did
you go home and say, I'm going to give this a shot?
Anyhow, no. So I walked out of the restaurant, and I hadn't really looked at his card, and I was walking down the sidewalk, and I looked at it just to see what it said, and I noticed the initials MS after his name. And thank God I was smart enough at the time to understand what those initials meant, Master Sommelier. And, you know, up until that point, I'd only ever heard of these people. I've never witnessed one in real life, you know. And so I was like, oh, my God, man, I've just met a Master Sommelier. This is insane. And so I immediately go home and, you know, Google or whatever I was using at the time, look up Frasca online and read about Bobby. I see he's French Laundry. He was with the Little Nell for a while. He's got all these accolades. Frasca is only open for dinner. It's closed on Sundays. I'm like, man, this is adding up to be really great. So I'm like, all right, well, I've got to go try to work here. If I'm going to do this wine thing, and this is perfect. So I go back the next day, to go fill out an application and walk in. You know, I dressed up, put a nice shirt on. I think I even maybe wore a tie.
Wow.
Yeah. And walk in. I'm like, hi, I'd like to fill out an application. And the girl, Kristen, who I still know, who's still there, who was behind the bar at the moment, she's like, yeah, we don't really have applications, but if you want to bring a resume,
oh boy,
then.
Screwed.
And I was like, oh, shit. Well, all right. I feel like an idiot now. So I leave and I go home and I write a resume. And I come back the next day, hand him my resume. They're like, thanks, we'll consider it. Didn't hear anything. So I come back the next day again, just wanted to check in. Came back every day for, I think, 6 or 7 days in a row. I think before they got the idea that, like, this kid is not going to leave us alone. Finally, Bobby, like, comes out, sits me down out on the patio. I was like, look, everybody starts at the bottom. You're going to have to, like, scrub floors, you know, scrub toilets, you're going to be a back waiter for a while. That's how everybody starts here. Luckily, they were just opening the patio out there at the time, and they needed one more server bumped up to have a server that could take care of the outside. So they had an opening then for a back server or, you know, busser or whatever they called it at the time. So I lucked out, and I said, great, sign me up. I don't care. I'll do whatever you want. It's fine. I just want a foot in the door. I'll work my ass off. It's fine. And that was that. So I think I started like a couple days later. And
did you do all kinds of tasks?
Yeah, everything. I mean, for like the first solid 6 months or so, I was scrubbing toilets and
you stayed there 3 years, though, right?
There 3 years.
And you ascended to.
By the time I left, I was buying wine for the restaurant.
Okay.
I think it was...
So basically Bobby and whoever he deemed to buy it were the wine buyers?
Well, Bobby actually wasn't... he was somewhat involved in the wine buying, but not...
So that was a high responsibility.
Yeah, yeah. Cool. There was two other people on the wine team with me at the time. I think I became a sommelier
what
there.
What years was that?
This was 2005 that I got the job there.
I think I was there when you were there.
Oh, yeah?
And I also think I was at 11 Madison a couple times.
Yeah, I definitely remember you from 11 Madison.
It's funny. Sure. All right, so let's zoom through this a little quicker, and I'll help you with it.
I told you I could talk for a while.
I know, and I love it all. You spend 3 years there. You know, Bobby's a big influence. You ascend to buying, and, you know, you got your sommelier chops down. There's a reason you leave after 3 years. Why?
Yeah. So Richard Betts was leaving the Little Nell Hotel.
Richard is another big name in wine
Master
then
sommelier.
And now, right?
Yeah, big guy
and
at Little Nell.
Like the fancy schmancy resort place.
Five-star,
right.
Five diamonds.
Montagna was the place?
Montagna at the Little Nell.
I don't think it's there anymore.
It's changed its name to Element 47 now.
So you go there... at a similar capacity?
Yeah. So when he left, it opened up the sommelier position.
Did you know Richard?
I didn't really know him much at the time, but he and Bobby were very close.
So Bobby,
Bobby heard
in a good word.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And so I went up and I worked a night of service and chatted with the team up there and, you know, landed the job. And I ended up being there for 2 years just as the sommelier. So I wasn't the wine buyer, but it was still a great job for a variety of reasons. I mean, you're working with a much bigger, comprehensive wine list, lots of French stuff on there. It was my first experience working with a Grand Award list, first time working with a lot of Burgundy. And
when you say Grand Award, the Wine Spectator?
Wine Spectator Grand Award,
Bobby care about being a Wine Spectator Grand Award list or not?
Not at Frosca. No, Frosca was never that kind of place.
Yeah.
No, Frosca was more telling the story than just trying to have a big wine list.
So you're there a couple of years.
Yep.
You leave there to go to San Francisco.
Correct.
But at some point, your MS idea is percolating around
now? Yeah, so it was actually when I was at Frosca. You know, like I said, when I first moved to Boulder, my intentions were to be there for like a year or two, and then I was going to come back east and go to grad school and go off and get a real job. originally, I just wanted to get an MBA, and I wasn't sure what I was going to do with it.
All right.
But I just knew I needed more school, and I wanted to go get a good job.
Okay.
But at some point in time, those 2 years came and went, and I was like, all right, dude, you got to like make a decision here. Are you going to go back home like you planned, or are you going to stay out here and keep goofing off or whatever you're doing?
Was there any appeal to going home? I mean, hopefully you're close with your family and that didn't... But
family,
Baltimore...
Family, for sure.
No skiing, nothing hip about it.
No, for me, it was more like a, you know, what am I doing with my life kind of thing, you know? And
So you don't head east. What happens?
It needed some validation. So at that point is when I decided, all right, well, I'm going to stay out here and I'm going to do the wine thing. I want to do this wine thing. I love it. It's great. And then I think for me to help validate that decision in my head, I needed something to pursue more serious with it. And I think that's where the Cord Master Sommeliers thing kind of fit for me. Not to mention Bobby was an MS. There's a number of other MSs in Colorado that I had been around. So a lot of these guys that I really looked up to at the time had gone that path and it seemed viable. And my intentions were to never actually go through the entire thing. I was like, I'll just take like the first couple levels maybe and then call it
a day. To help you get better
at
understanding
wine. Yeah, just to like get better, you know, have the certification. That's it. And then I'm sure as many people who are going through the process know, you know, you take one, you makes it want to take the next level. And then you pass that one, it makes you want to take the next. Anywho, so I was already, I think, past the certified by the time I went up to Aspen. And then while I was in Aspen, I passed the advanced.
Wow.
And I actually went and sat for the masters once while I was still in Aspen as well, but didn't pass the first time out.
What year is that?
This would have been 2009 that I took it the first time. No, sorry, 2010. You're right that I took it the first time. And then San Francisco kind of came calling. Literally, Raj Parr, another great sommelier.
We had Raj on the show about a month ago.
He's the man.
He's a sweetheart.
Sweetheart of a guy.
Yeah.
But he was looking for a somm, and
but just 1 second. Raj is one of those guys where you were classically trained. I mean, you went through the whole MS thing.
Yep.
Raj can rival anyone and didn't do that.
Correct.
There's a special guy, and you're one of them for sure. And certainly Raj is without that formal training. But,
right.
You know, a nose and a palate like
yeah.
anyone
I mean,
else.
One of the best palates I've ever seen. Yeah. Which so, actually that's part of what drew me to him and to that was, you know, I had been mentored and been trained under so many people that have gone that quartermaster sommelier's path. I felt, you know, if I had somebody else like Raj, it could really help round me out a little bit, get a different perspective on wine, and it could change things around a little bit. And obviously I was very drawn to his way of tasting and his palate.
So you go to RN74?
RN74.
That's Michael Mina.
Michael Mina Restaurant. Yep. It's in the Millennium Tower building.
Good as any place in the country.
Again, this was about a year or so into their launch, and they had won the Grand Award in their first year. Huge list, really deep in Burgundy. RN74 is really all about Burgundy. So it was, again, a place where I could hone in my skills.
That was your biggest dose of Burgundy knowledge.
Huge,
certainly
yeah,
not
huge.
Frasca, right?
Well, French wine in general. No, Frasca right. was cutting my teeth with Italian.
Right.
You know, the Nell was great for, like, a more worldly, broad perspective on wine. And then RN74 was, like, a lot of French, a lot of California.
Right.
Especially at the time, it was, like, the new wave of California
they
stuff.
They had to have it because yeah. of proximity.
But it was cool. You know, Raj's thing at the time was, I don't want any Chardonnay or Pinot Noir over 14% alcohol. It was like his rule, you know? And he was pissed a lot of people off with that. But,
but it was interesting. He did IPOB.
Yeah, then he's IPOB. The first IPOB was in the lobby of RN74.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
I saw pictures. Yeah. Jasmine Hirsch
well,
was
there.
Also on.
And I remember thinking to myself, I'm like, man, this is awesome. Like, I didn't realize California was doing such cool shit. And, yeah, it made me fall in love with California wine again. And at the same time, I was learning a ton about Burgundy and French wine in general, Rhone, et cetera. It was an amazing, amazing experience. And
right, so you're there how long?
Just a year.
A year.
A quick year, yeah.
And during that time, two questions. One, where are you at with the MS? And when does the somm, the movie somm, come into play?
Yes. Then? So I actually sat and passed my master's exam February of 2011. So it was about, what is that, 4 or so months into me working at RN74.
And up until that point, how many years were you studying for it? 4 or 5 years?
When I passed, it was 5 years.
5 years.
Yeah, from the time I took the intro until when I passed
and
the
MS, talking studying all day, working all night,
all the time.
A lot of the
yeah,
time,
yeah, yeah.
right?
All Most the time. Yeah,
that's the commitment.
That was my
that
life.
People, right. It's crazy.
Yeah, I did nothing except for study, taste, and work.
So how does the movie... Somm is a movie where they followed Master Sommelier candidates. If you haven't seen it, it's on Netflix. It's widely available. You should see it. Dustin's a big part of it. How did they come to you to be in the movie?
So when I was living in Aspen, and I took my advance, actually, the year I passed my advance, I met a guy named Brian McClintock. He was a mutual friend of another friend of mine named Ian Cobble. Ian and I had seen each other at exams and competitions.
Was Ian in the movie?
He was.
Yeah.
He was dad. Yeah.
Right. That's right.
He's the crazy guy. In the
right.
Movie. Yeah.
He doesn't pass.
Sorry, Ian.
Felt so bad when he didn't pass, right?
I know. Yeah.
That was tough.
So Ian and I knew each other prior. We had seen each other at competitions and exams and that kind of thing. And Brian was with him. I guess they were close. And after the advance exam, Brian reaches out to me randomly. It's like, hey, man, it was nice meeting you at the exam. I'm looking for a somm gig somewhere or someplace where I can be more in touch with wine. If you know of anything, let me know. And, you know, I knew we were looking for captains at the Little Nell. And I was like, look, if you want to move to Aspen, you could probably score your job super easy at the Nell. You'd be a captain there. You work with me and Jonathan on wine. You know, we could definitely get you involved in some capacity, even if it's like just handling bottles, helping with inventory, learning how like things come and go, that sort of thing. And he's like, all right, yeah, that sounds good. So he picked up and moved to Aspen. And the point I'm getting to is we became study buddies. We were very close. And his friend is Jason Wise, who directed the film.
So there's the connection.
Yeah. So and Brian had one day, I remember sitting at Brian's apartment outside of Aspen. We're studying. He's like, "Hey, just FYI, a buddy of mine wants to like film us while we're studying for this stuff. Would you be into it?" And I was like, "Yeah, I don't care. That's fine."
Nobody cared.
Right? Yeah, it's like at the time, like, "Yeah, okay, some dude's going to come over with like a handheld, you know, cassette video camera."
It was just pretty informal.
Right.
I mean, it wasn't a lighting crew. And
exactly. Like, yeah. And I was like, "Yeah, that's fine. Whatever. Totally cool." And so then I remember the process of it becoming a fundraising thing, and we were reaching out to people to try to get some money to get the film off the ground and that sort of jazz.
I remember that.
And it took a while to get it rolling, but then eventually they picked up a little bit of money. Jason started filming Ian first. So when I first went out for my master's exam, Jason was there filming, but Brian, myself, nobody else was involved really except for Ian. In fact, my first experience meeting Jason was he was picking me up after I had been a long night of drinking after the master's exam, and I found out I failed.
Oh, boy.
Myself and a couple buddies.
Drinking you. Bowls
we're in
away.
We're in Napa just getting after it hard.
Boy.
I mean, hammered, karaoke,
so
you name it.
That happened during the movie as...
Well, he had started filming at that point, yes.
It ran into each other.
Yeah. It wasn't until I moved to San Francisco that he said, "All right, I need more guys involved. Dustin, are you ready to be filmed?" I said, "Sure." And that's when D-Lynn got involved. Brian got involved.
What year was that?
So this was... It would have been 2010.
It took a couple years to film
and
the movie.
And he filmed us for... I mean, it would seem to be close to a year.
The movie came out in 2012, so you're talking 10, 11, so a good year plus.
Yeah, but what was interesting is when he wrapped filming, the editing process took like a solid year or
so. Oh, really?
And then when he started pitching the film to get picked up, that took some time. So by the time it actually came out and people started watching it and hearing about it, so a good amount of time had passed, and I almost got to the point where I forgot we did it.
Right.
You know,
but when it came out,
and then it came out,
it
and
got
it was
critical
like, holy
acclaim.
Shit.
The industry loved it, and then it opened up, you know, to everyone else.
Yeah.
It was such an interesting subject matter. People don't realize the intensity and the commitment. It's like these guys are nuts.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, it's funny because I remember the first time sitting down to watch it. I got like the preview DVD and popped it in, and I was again, you know, Jason was like sleeping on a couch on the floor. It was him and like one other guy most of the time. It was very informal. So I still hadn't expected all that much out of it, honestly.
I saw it a few times, and you really feel, you
it's
know,
definitely authentic.
It's authentic. You feel the tension. You feel the commitment. I mean,
it was not
guys,
a big budget thing.
You guys
at
pulled
all.
It off.
But I popped in.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely.
I pop in the DVD, and I'm like, dude, I'm like, this is like legit. This is real. This is looks good.
It's legit because you guys were legit. All right, so let's finish up on the life's travels. So you leave, the movie's done. You talked about popping it in the DVD. You finish up, you head to New York to not arguably today, but what is the number one restaurant in the world?
Yes.
You only had 4 stars and four New York Times stars, 3 Michelin stars, you know, as you were there. But you leave the West Coast to come to?
Yeah, 11 Madison Park.
And just quickly, how does that come about?
So, if people remember, 11 Madison Park was a part of the
Danny Meyer
Union Square Hospitality Group with Danny Meyer.
And you were there when it was still under Danny's ownership.
Correct. So, what many people also don't realize is 11 Madison Park's been around since 1998.
Right.
A lot of people just think it's a relatively new restaurant because
it was like
his
third restaurant or something.
Yeah, it was like.
And Madison Square Park was like a shitty area, like
correct.
Union Square. And, you know, he brought
so
that.
He had Union Square, Gramercy, and then I think he opened Tabla and 11 Madison Park
with Floyd.
At the same time, they were basically in adjoining spaces.
Right.
Anyhow,
what's your
where
connection?
Was I? So,
what's the connection to get you west to 11 Madison?
When the chef Daniel Hume and Will Gadara, who at the time was the general manager,
Working for Danny, right?
They were working for Danny. They made plans to purchase the restaurant from Danny Meyer and split off and start their own group. When that those conversations started taking place and taking hold, the wine director that was there prior to me, John Reagan, had a decision to make. He was either going to stick with USHG and Danny Meyer and that group, or, you know, go off into the unknown with Will and Daniel.
He's still at US.
So he made the call to stick with Danny and USHG. I think that was a route he wanted to take and become their corporate wine director. He's still that to this day. He's killing it. Which opened up a spot at 11 Madison Park. Luckily, through some mutual friends, and, you know, I got to thank my lucky stars for all the people that I've met along the way. Because it's insane that, you know, that you talk about place and time and being in the right place at the right time. And I had that luck for sure. When they were looking, they reached out to who else but Bobby Stuckey, Richard Betts, like a hand, Rajat Parr.
They didn't want to leave.
All these people, they were like, hey, you know, who they should we be looking at?
They didn't grow up in Baltimore. That's why.
And, you know, luckily all these guys were like, oh, yeah, you should check out Dustin. And by the time they called me, they're like, dude, who are you? That like all these people are... You know all these people and you run into it and worked with all these people. You know, I thank my lucky stars every day for that.
And you did that for 4 years.
Yeah, so I came out there pretty much a year to the day from when I started at EMP or at RN74 and was at 11 Madison Park for just about 4 years.
And you said you got there, it was a Danny Meyer, Gramercy, I mean Union Square Hospitality.
Yeah.
In the 4 years you were there, when did it flip?
Right basically away. Like 2 months later. So, or 3 months later. I started in like late September, early October, and by January it was under new leadership.
I think Danny went through that with Tom Colicchio and Kraft and didn't want to go through it again with Will and Daniel.
Yeah, I mean it was so I think especially at the time because
but isn't he a small partner or something in it? He
may I don't know. But I do know, you know, those guys helped raise the bar for 11 Madison Park.
Yes. To this day.
They were planning to, they wanted something of their own and they were going to leave 11 Madison
Park. To do that.
And go do something on their own if he didn't give them the restaurant. So he felt it, you know, God bless Danny. He felt that the best thing to do is, you know, let's make this happen, do the deal and you guys take it and run.
Just as a side note, there's a thing called the world's 50 best restaurants.
Yep.
Is it Pellegrino? Sponsored?
Pellegrino, yeah.
And
when I started
last year, it was Massimo Bottura from Modena was number one. This year, 11 Madison is number
one. Yeah, when I started, they had just jumped from number 50 on that list to number 25.
I remember.
And then we went up to number 11, then 10, then like five, then three. It was a wild ride.
So you did that for 4 years. We'll weave back and forth into that. You leave there, top of the world. Why and for what?
I know I get that all the time. So I left to go start Verve. Verve is my wine retail project.
Something you were thinking about while you were there?
Yeah, yeah.
Like one day I'm going to walk out of the restaurant business.
Totally.
Okay. And Verve is
Verve Wine. We have a retail store, brick and mortar retail store down in Tribeca here in the city.
All right. Stop right there because we're going to come back a little later.
All right.
And, you know, focus on the show. I want you to talk about that. I just want to ask you a bunch of questions before we get into your projects and help me decipher some of this. People are still intimidated by wine, wine stores, sommeliers, restaurant wine lists, and you've had your hand on all of that.
Yeah.
And you're not the type of guy, disposition, personality-wise, where you want to impose or be intimidating.
Correct.
What do you tell people to break through? You know, all of that going into your store, which I know you want to make the experience easy, or the wine list. A couple makes a reservation 6 months in advance at 11 Madison, 160 page.
Correct.
How do you get away from that intimidation?
Yeah, I think, I mean, for me, it was always, and you know, I come from the Bobby Stuckey school, is, you know, you use hospitality to kind of make people feel at home and feel comfortable. And, you know, you always want to make sure that you're speaking to them on their level and making them feel home and good.
But not everyone does that.
No,
some people, you know, are imposing and don't give a shit.
Totally.
So that was the way you connected.
Yeah, and for me, it was like, I want to make sure when people leave any interaction with me that they leave happy and excited. So and feel like they learned maybe a little something. So, you know, I think a lot of people might use the sommelier platform to show off how much they know.
It's not about you. It's about
them. It's about the guests. Yeah. And at the end of the day, a lot of guests don't understand jargon.
So what should they do? Ask a lot of questions, tell people what they like. I mean, how do you?
Yeah. I think for me, it was always,
you pulled it out of them.
I've always done it the same way since I was taught from day one, which is like, you ask people what they love, what they're into, what's the last thing that they can remember that they've had that they enjoyed. You get that frame of reference, and then you kind of go into it with them.
But wouldn't you say some sommeliers just want to kind of impress people and push what they give a crap about, which
totally.
Is really the wrong end of the spectrum?
Yeah, and you know, I think there is certain value for sommeliers having a strong perspective. That's what helps change the industry. It's what helps trends evolve. And
right,
you know, if people didn't have opinions and perspectives, then we'd all just be stagnant all the time, which would be boring.
Right.
So I don't think that it's invaluable at all. I think it's just you know, how you do that, and making sure that at the end of the day, it's the guest and the person that you're talking to.
That so remember, you're
keeping
the guest.
Their best interests in mind at all times.
Don't let guys like Dustin. You know, push you around. Has the one? You're a young guy. You've done a lot. You know, in a long, you know, not a short, not a long period of time, but very condensed. Has the business changed a lot since you've been in it? I mean, have you seen a lot of changes for the good?
Yeah, I think.
Worse.
Oof. I mean, I definitely see the trends with wine. I remember like Riesling and Grüner Veltliner were like the hotness. Back in 2005 when I was first getting into it, I remember reading like certain magazines, Wine and Spirits.
They're hot
things like
now,
that.
Though.
They are, but they were like just getting cool. Oh, okay. Like,
so they're
now
on a good
it's
ride,
natural wine's
though.
Cool and Jura right. wine is cool. And,
right. Loire
you know,
Valley.
Shannon, you know.
All right, like, take it easy on Pascaline, will you?
But
she's a friend of the show.
You know, back then it was like everybody just wanted to talk about Grüner Veltliner all the time.
So I guess to not decipher, but to look at that answer, there's been a lot of trends.
It's a lot of trends.
Trendy and people yeah. sort of, and I guess sommeliers are influencers, so they carry the trend.
What I love about the industry and kind of what's happened to it over the last few years, at least that I've witnessed, is people are, at least generally speaking, that there's a shift away from so much reliance on critics.
Well, I want to get to that because I have a social media question.
Oh,
and I think
okay, we're not there yet.
No,
I'm getting
but
ahead.
While I have you here, but file that.
All right,
because you hit it right where I wanted to go. But before we get to that, while I have you here, and we may talk a little about it with Verve because we got a break in a few minutes. But talk to me right now in your mind. I only care what you think. What's exciting in wine? What wines are exciting? What regions? To you, to the store, you know, it doesn't have to be trendy, but where is your focus towards right now?
Yeah. For me, I'm realizing more and more that there's really awesome wine from a lot of places that's not expensive.
Give me, you know,
like this week alone, I've honestly, I've been focusing all my tastings on like Southern Hemisphere stuff, which is not my wheelhouse.
Are you
frankly.
Talking Africa and South America?
I'm talking mostly South Africa, New Zealand, Australia.
Okay.
And
not
it's
the
exciting.
Typical varietals anymore. Everybody used to think Australia Syrah. It's much
yeah,
deeper.
Well, it's
New
some
Zealand.
A lot of it. Some of it is the same varieties, but
there's
you know,
others.
Just different styles. And there's everybody's breaking the mold on what. People thought these wines were, and it gets me super excited because I just look at it, I'm like, man, there is such good stuff everywhere. Because for me, I remember tasting and trying to buy wine for restaurants not that long ago, where you tasted something from Australia, it's like the same old stuff, it's
right?
Like the same 15% alcohol, crazy Barossa Shiraz. That,
but they went through that period, they closed down a little, and now you know they're
yeah.
back in the game. Australia had their you know problems.
It's just exciting because you can find like really delicious wines from a lot of different places that have great stories.
So if you had to condense it into a handful of recommendations, what in Australia, what in South Africa?
Oh, I mean, I don't know.
Are you talking still staying with Syrah's a varietal?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, this will encapsulate it. There's Pinot a lot Noir of producers in Australia now that are putting the word Syrah on their label instead of Shiraz.
Ah, okay.
And, you know, it's a little thing, but it's also a psychological thing for them where it's
right.
like we're not making the same Shiraz type of wines that our predecessors did.
Adelaide Hills. And-
so it's cool.
What
it's
about-
super cool.
What about South Africa?
Yeah.
I mean, are there varietals or regions? I know, what is it, Swartland is doing a whole natural wine thing?
Yeah, and there's like Elgin and Walker Bay and some of these the cool climate areas. That
what are the predominant varietals?
You're looking at a lot of Chenin Blanc, a lot of Syrah, some Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, that kind of stuff. So not necessarily wacky grapes, but
Blancenfrosch or whatever they make there.
Blancfrankisch,
right.
So the grapes aren't necessarily all that weird. What I'm finding is just the quality is steadily increasing. I honestly wrote off South African wines years ago because I tasted as much as I could and I just couldn't find anything that
and
I liked.
Now you're feeling good about
and
it.
And now I'm like, just in the last 2 weeks alone, have tasted a lot of really fun things. And
so not to go all over
eye-opening.
The place, I guess the takeaway is on your recommendation, Southern Hemisphere, South Africa,
I guess what I'm saying
Australia.
Is don't ever write off a region.
Right.
Keep your mind open because... you know, for me, I used to be like, you know what? South African wines suck. I don't like South African wines. And now I'm kicking myself because I'm like, there's actually a lot of good stuff here.
All right. I'm going to ask you one more question, and then we're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to do the wine list. Then I want to get into your projects, and we're going to taste some wine. So I had pushed you off to this. Social media.
Mm-hmm.
How has it changed? How has it changed wine during your tenure in wine?
Yeah. Well, I think this kind
of
plays
critics.
Into the critic thing. Social media has developed, I think, a lot of new experts, I guess you could say.
Instead of the same 3, 4, 5.
Correct. Now there's dozens, if not hundreds, of
I
people.
I use this
that,
word all the time, and tell me if you agree. It's more democratized.
Totally is, yeah, which
instead
is a great
of,
thing.
Right.
I think that's one of the trends that I really love to see is people, you know, used to be following... like you said, 3, 4 people, and they had the dominance of the entire industry. And that's,
right.
you know, they changed the industry completely. And they changed the way wine was made and, you know, what people consumed.
Now you have bloggers,
but now there's
delectable.
There's
writers,
so many different types of people
punch,
out there.
You
correct.
Know, all greens.
That are all, you know, have their own voice and, consumers now have the opportunity to kind of pick and choose from a number of different viewpoints on wine.
So
it's not about points and scores anymore. It's about the stories and the way the wine tastes. And I think it's much more interesting now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's one aspect. The other aspect is how wine personalities use it to
mm-hmm.
promote their brands on Instagram or
yeah.
Snapchat.
Yeah.
You know, there's a whole forum for people to get their messages out.
Totally.
So you
That's
can
a great
hear
thing.
From the winemaker. You can hear it from sommeliers. You can hear it from other
It's just
reviewers.
Another platform for them to use to tell the stories they want to tell. And it's
so
great.
Social media in your mind has had nothing but a positive effect on
I think
it.
It's had a great effect. I think, you know, if it's used the right way, I mean, I would say the one
well,
trend...
like any...
Yeah, yeah. The one trend I don't love is just the pure searching of wines that are essentially unattainable. The
right.
pure FOMO
right.
shots, you know, like, ah, look at yeah. this flight of
the $25,000
50-year-old DRC wines that yeah, I yeah. tasted tonight. Yeah. Ha, 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 ha. Don't you wish you were me?
Right.
Like, I mean, I get it. It's fun because you want to document
what?
That experience, but at the
you
same time.
You get to
time,
see it. You know,
right.
it's out there, so you get to see it. But I agree.
You're
with
rubbing
you.
It in people's faces.
I think there's a whole separate social media argument that people are just doing stuff for other people to see.
Correct.
You know, where there's a lot of education and criticism, which is more important.
Yeah.
All right. So we're talking to Dustin Wilson. Dustin's a master sommelier. We heard where he came from. He's also the proprietor of Verve Wine in New York City, which we're going to talk about. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to subject Dustin to the wine list, talk about his projects, and then me, Dustin, and Trouty, you're going to taste a little wine on air. So we'll be right back. ¶¶
Bob's Red Mill has been milling whole grains since 1978. When you mill whole grains, you get all three parts: the bran, the germ, and the endosperm. The bran, or the roughage, makes up about 14% of the whole grain. It's the outer skin of the edible kernel. It contains large amounts of B vitamins, some protein, trace minerals, phytochemicals, but most importantly, dietary fiber. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
Hey, like what you hear? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. With fresh programming every week, we've got something for everyone. Trying to start your own food business? Concerned about where your food comes from? Looking for the best wine or beer to bring to a party? Find our shows on iTunes or Stitcher, or head to heritageradionetwork.org to listen live and subscribe to our newsletter.
All right, we're back. We're back. You're listening to The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. My guest is Dustin Wilson.
Hello.
Master sommelier, proprietor of Verve Wine. All right, Dustin, nobody leaves the Heritage Radio Network studios without answering the wine list, excuse me. So I'm going to give you a bunch of questions. And
I'm not prepared.
You shouldn't be. That's the beauty of this. Answer them honestly and succinctly, all right? First question, and you may have answered this. What are you drinking now? What are you tasting? What keeps reappearing? Whether it's personal, for the store, but what are you drinking now?
Right now, I am drinking mostly Northern Rhone wines.
Okay.
And it's been that way for a good chunk of time now.
Give me a couple of specifics that you're liking.
Yeah. Pierre Gonon, Saint-Joseph.
My all-time favorite.
Monnier Perrol, Saint-Joseph. Domain 4E.
What's that? Give me the second one.
Monnier Perrol.
We have to spell sometimes on the show.
M-O-N-I-E-R is the first
Monnier
word.
Monnier
Perrol is P-E-R-R-E-O-L.
And give me a price point retail on the
Perrol. Like probably in the mid-30 range.
Is Perrol cheaper than the Gonon?
Yes.
Okay.
It is now.
So that's a good one. Give me one more.
What else do I really like? Julien Session. Great little producer. He makes a delicious little Crow's Hermitage.
Spell Session.
C-E-C-I-L-L-O-N.
Okay. All right. Next question. Your favorite wine and food pairing?
Ooh, that is a good question. Probably champagne and oysters.
Oh boy, I'm gonna have to ask you to leave now. No, that's the classic answer. It's either champagne and oysters,
muscadet
and oysters. But you're right. But I've gotten champagne and popcorn, champagne and fried chicken, champagne and pizza.
You know,
I will play tapes of shows where I say, give me your favorite wine and food pairing. Don't tell me champagne and oysters.
Oh, man.
But
it's so good.
You are, for you, it's the perfect answer because you're right.
You know, I go to Aspen every year.
You have the cred to.
And we sit on the patio at Ajax Tavern. And you look up in the sunshine and you get a couple bottles of champagne, a huge thing of oysters, and you're in heaven.
Nothing like eating oysters.
West Coast or East Coast oysters?
East Coast.
East Coast.
East Coast. Okay. Briny. Yeah.
Blanc de Blanc. Blanc de Noir.
Blanc de Blanc.
Trouty's
so
from
get
the Cape.
Specific.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nothing like eating oysters in a landlocked state. But we'll get to that another time. All right. Tell me your favorite wine restaurant and or bar. Somebody where wine is a critical part of the experience.
Here in the city.
In the city. And if you want to give me, you have another favorite place, I'll take that too.
Yeah, right now my favorite place to go is Compagnie de Vins Surnaturel.
We had Caliban a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, they're Caleb is the man.
They're doing
we work
nice
together at
Caleb.
EMP.
Are you doing?
I love it. It's great.
Are you doing a mixtape there?
I have done a mixtape already.
Okay.
I'm pressuring him to allow me to do the remix.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Company is a wine bar with terrific food. How about something outside of New York?
Outside of New York, I would say, oh, man, probably Frasca.
Okay, you're
Boulder.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
It's a great
fair
place
and
to
square.
Drink wine.
And the tribute to him is that many years later, it's still
oh, yeah.
as good as
it's
any
so end. Good.
All right, your favorite all-time wine?
favorite all-time wine.
Is there a wine that moved you? Is there a wine that the experience?
I'm going to sound like such a douche by saying this probably, but when I passed...
There's no douches in here.
When I passed the MS exam, my sommelier buddies at the time in SF treated me to a bottle of 1980 Latache. So the wine was amazing.
Okay.
And B, it was with the right people, and it was the right moment.
That's as much the experience as the wine.
It really probably could have been anything, but that was one of the most memorable
Latache
wines, wine experiences that I've ever had.
All right, last question, and you are super qualified to answer this. Best wine retail around $15. I need a red. I need a white. Trouty's going to dinner. Six people bringing 2-3 bottles. Doesn't want to spend the world. What's he buying for around 15? Give me a red. Give me a white.
Yeah, let's see. All right, so white wine. I would say there's this Muscadet producer called Complementaire.
Spell.
C-O-M-P-L-E. It's spelled like compliment, but with E-R-R-E at the end.
Okay, Complementaire.
Complementaire.
Because I get a lot of Olivier and Le Pepier.
Yep, it's a great little Muscadet that's like, it's...
12, 13 bucks.
It's either unsulfured or very low sulfur, and it's extremely aromatic, but it has all the other great qualities of Muscadet. It's
sounds
delicious.
Good. And that goes with oysters too, right?
It does indeed.
Give me a red.
Red right now, tougher. I would say Columbera and Gorella.
All right, nobody understands that.
So
is that the type of wine? The name?
Columbera is the name. So it's two partners. Columbera and Gorella are the two guys.
Okay,
two
spell
names.
For me.
Columbera just kind of as it sounds. C-O-L-O-M-B-E-R-A.
B-R-A. Columbera.
And Gorella is G-A-R-E-L-L-A.
Okay. And where is that from?
They're up in Alto Piemonte, so the northern part of Piemonte. It's a Nebbiolo-based wine.
Right.
They make a few wines. The Costa della Sessia is the more inexpensive wine. I can't say that it's $15.
But $15, $20?
Yes,
and
for
sure. The money?
The money, it's banging.
It's funny. I had Laura Maniac in here, and I said, what are you liking now? And she said, Alta Piemonte.
Yeah. Great wines.
It had come up.
Great wines.
All right, so those are two good choices. All right, so let's get back to a few other things, and then we're going to taste some wine.
Cool.
So you have your hands currently in a bunch of different things. You have your own wine label. You have a distribution company. And you have a recently opened wine store. Let's start with your wine company. It's called Valin, V-A-L-L-I-N.
Correct.
What is Valin?
Valin is a partnership between myself and a couple of sommelier buddies and a winemaker. We started in 2000, or our first vintage was 2012. The idea for it came about when I was still living in San Francisco and was very fascinated by the trend of like the IPOB, the wines of balance,
right?
This new wave of California stuff, and so much attention was being paid to Chardonnay and Pinot Noir at the time. And I love Syrah. I like drinking Côte Rôti and that kind of stuff.
Northern.
And so we were like, man, we should take this same mentality and apply it to Syrah and make some really delicious, cool climate, balanced style Syrah that's made in the way that we like to drink from the old world, but you know, coming from California, let's be a part of this wave.
So you searched for and suppliers?
Well, we searched for someone that would help us on the winemaker side first, and we came across that with Justin Willett.
Justin's background is what?
So he worked for Arcadian under Joe Davis for some time, and then launched his own wine label called Tyler back in 2005.
Very good, popular wine. Man.
Super delicious. Yeah, and great wines.
Great
Pinot and Chard.
And great price points, too. It's
yes,
not a crazy
indeed.
Expensive
indeed.
One. So he's your winemaker.
He's the winemaker. And, you know, our goal was like, hey, we don't want to discount the terroir of where the wine's coming from. We want this to be a California wine.
Predominantly from where?
It's all Santa Barbara.
Okay.
Yeah, we harvest from a few different sites around Santa Barbara. We wanted it to be a pure Santa Barbara expression, but stylistically and from a vinification standpoint, we wanted to utilize methods done in the old world. So more whole cluster fermentation, less use of new oak. Actually, there's no new oak on it. We try to use as little sulfur as possible.
When you say no new oak, you're using barrels.
Correct.
But you're using oak barrels that have been used. So
used numerous
a lot
times.
Of the woody
wood flavors
been
are
sucked
gone.
Out.
Exactly.
But as a vessel, it's storage and it imparts a little something?
It imparts, because it's still an oxidative environment.
Okay.
At least to a certain extent. You know, there's cracks and whatnot in the barrel. So.
When you use a barrel, what are you talking about? It's been used 3-4 times before
these were at least 3 times, if not more. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. We didn't make much. It's always been like a fun side thing that we just really like. I like drinking the wine myself.
Did it come out the way you hoped it would?
Yeah, it's been better than I thought it would.
Do you make something besides Syrah?
We did before. Our first vintage, we made a little Grenache too.
Okay.
We also have a white wine. It's a Viognier and Marsan blend.
Nice.
But then we realized that if we wanted to kind of focus on this Northern Rhone thing, then Grenache didn't make sense. We actually made a rosé the first year too. So we bagged the rosé, bagged the Grenache. So now it's just 2 wines.
So if people want to get the wine, it's a very small production wine.
Yes.
But if their curiosity's piqued and they're enticed, what's their best thing to do? Go on the website?
Yeah, they can buy it through Verve for sure.
Okay.
That would be my first recommendation.
So anybody anywhere around the country could get...
Yeah.
In touch with Verve. When we get to Verve, we'll give them all the contact info and all that. All right. So that's going on. You have grapes in the ground for this fall's vintage, your next vintage.
Correct.
All right. So let's talk about Anvil.
Yeah.
Anvil is another company of yours. It is a import distribution company.
Distribution, really.
Distribution?
Yep. So Anvil came about... A good buddy of mine who, when I was working at Ruth's Chris Steakhouse back in the day.
Wow.
Good buddy, Matt. Matt and I drank a lot of wine together back then. We kind of were getting into wine right around the same time. He went off and became a lawyer. I went off and became a sommelier. He calls me like a few years ago and says, hey, I kind of don't want to do this lawyer thing anymore. I want to get into wine. He needed somebody to help him get into that world.
Separate of you and him seeing each other, just something.
We had seen each other a little bit here and there.
But were not the major influence in why he wanted to do that.
No, I think he always liked wine. I think he enjoyed tasting it. It was a hobby of his, but it wasn't. I don't think he got the bug to do anything with it until he kind of had to make a decision about if he's staying in law or not. He had come to see me at 11 Madison Park a few times, and we'd stayed in contact. So when I was wrapping up at 11 Madison Park and planning Verve, we still had some time before Verve was going to launch. So I helped him kind of get this thing off the ground, and it's great. We started as a small portfolio of basically all French wine in the beginning.
So let's tell people what it is. You do this in the state of Colorado.
Yes. So it's in Colorado.
You're a distributor in Colorado. So your goal...
We sell wine to restaurants and retailers in Colorado.
But the goal is... to bring wines in that you like that are not available in the market.
Correct. Yeah. So our thing has always been
distribution
for the
them.
Most part, wines that had not been represented there before. So a bit of an uphill battle for anybody that's trying to launch new brands in a market.
Right.
It, it takes time.
How many different, wines are you distributing?
Now,
I'm going to guess 55 plus.
Yeah, probably.
Because I counted.
Oh, you did? Okay.
So it's about 55.
Yeah, we started out with like 10.
The predominant country is France?
Mostly French, yeah.
Right. Some Italian,
we've
Germany,
got a little Italian,
USA.
A great German book now, a couple of domestic producers. And it's been great, super fun. It gives me a reason to go back to Colorado on a somewhat regular basis.
Perfect.
My role is I kind of feed producers his way and... give him some pointers and tell him what he's missing out if he's not buying something else. And it's been great to watch it grow.
Well, if in the course of this conversation you went from 10 to over 50 wines, then it's going in the right direction.
It's been great.
So that's a good thing. All right, let's talk about what you're currently doing, what keeps you up at night, what you spend 15, 16 hours a day doing. You opened a retail wine store with all your background. You opened a retail wine store late last year called Verve Wine, Verve Wine in New York City. What's the address?
24 Hubert Street.
And that's Tribeca.
Tribeca. Tribeca.
All right. So what was the goal, the objective, the mission statement when you wanted to open for not the first wine store in that neighborhood, certainly not the only one in Correct. New York?
Yeah. I mean, for us, we just wanted to kind of bring our perspective on wine and our vision of hospitality, I think, to the wine retail world.
So hospitality.
Hospitality, for sure.
Which you don't necessarily get, and you have a huge background.
And experience, you know. And I think for me, I just, when you shop for wine or when you are learning about wine and, you know, also come in, to put it into context, we're looking at a day and age right now where the consumption of wine is growing at a very rapid rate. And the consumer that is buying all this wine is starting to change dramatically.
How?
I mean, the younger generation, I hate rambling on about millennials, but millennials are now represent the largest wine market in the country, the largest wine market in the history of wine drinking in the U.S. And they're changing the way that wine is bought and sold and what's important about it and what's not.
So you know the market and you have to pivot to them.
Yeah. So what's it, you know, for me, it's, I'm like an, I guess a very, very old millennial or very young Gen Xer. So
but,
I'm like
but not
kind of an in-between
touch.
Guy, right. You know? So for me,
but
I,
to have the experience you have, you know, you can't be a millennial. I mean,
right.
So you have right. the best of both worlds.
Yes,
you're
exactly.
still on the fringe in a good way.
I'm on the fringe,
and
for
you have
sure.
have good experience.
So, but I, what I saw was an opportunity to kind of just freshen things up a little bit and bring more of the experience, especially like the online piece and social media and the way we present ourselves to the world and the way we talk about wine. Create an environment that's fun, educational, and approachable for the younger wine consumer.
So education is important.
Huge.
Is the online portion becoming a nice chunk of the business?
It's on its way there.
And you're working hard towards that.
Totally. Yeah. Right. That's where we see the most potential, and that's where I want to see it grow, and we're putting a lot of effort into that.
Would you say that the store specializes predominantly in European wines?
It's a lot of European wine, for sure.
Does it fold into a handful of countries, or you're trying to develop?
Right now, yeah, it's mostly French and French and Italian, I would say. But a good chunk of Spain, Germany, Austria, scattering around Europe.
Right. Like you said, all these regions.
Right,
pushing
right.
out great wine.
A good chunk of domestic stuff. A lot of California, but a little bit of Oregon, even New right. York, et cetera. And, you know, for us, though, it's more about the producer and how they make their wines. And we look for small family-owned wineries that that show great respect for their land, their sense of place.
So you're really curating.
Super curated.
What you're carrying.
Exactly.
And that hopefully is part of the education part. Let
yeah.
people know.
We don't care about points. I couldn't care less about points.
That's where online is a good forum for that, right?
Yes.
You can really speak about the wine.
Right. We like the stories behind the wines, and we want things that are made in a, you know, healthy, sustainable way. And
right.
That stuff's important to us. And we're not necessarily dogmatic about the wines being, you know, quote unquote natural.
Right.
It's such a broad thing anyways. Some white Burgundies that I think are some of the most amazing wines in the world, they use a bunch of sulfur.
Right.
It just is what it is.
Right.
We're not going to like write them off just because they use too much sulfur. So,
you said somewhere you didn't want the shop to feel like it just sells high end wines.
Yeah.
You know, that always.
So we do have some high end wine, honestly. And like, and I've been talking about those wines and selling those wines, drinking those wines for years now. But I honestly get more excited about like the $20 stuff.
Yeah.
Honestly,
that
it's great. Yeah.
Like, cause
I love finding this stuff. It's so good.
Yeah. That's funny. Cause somebody could walk in cause they know who you were. They were excited. You opened the store. They get a chance to stand with you for 20 minutes, walk out with a case of curated wines,
and not have to spend a ton of money. It's great.
And then some guy who has no clue walks out with the same case, you know, and it just has the same benefit.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's the best place to go to for any of that.
So it's fun, too, because, you know, we have some of the high-end stuff, and, you know, I like those wines, obviously.
You need them for your client base,
too. Totally, and there's a lot of people in New York City. I mean, there's a lot of people that want those wines, and
especially downtown.
I can talk about them all day, so it's fun to have them there, but...
Now, you have a thing called, it's a very cool thing, and if there's other features, tell me after, Somm's Corner. Yeah. You have a lot of sommelier friends, and I guess after you being on, you know, for the past hour and talking about sommeliers in general, these guys kind of know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the Somm's Corner?
So we have a little, it's really a little section of the store where we feature some wines that are either made by sommeliers, because there's a lot of guys like myself who make wine, like my good friend Thomas Pastuchek from The Nomad, Raj Parr, Bobby Stuckey, Richard Betts. There's a lot of sommeliers out there now that make wine. So we've got their wines, or it's kind of like the funky, wacky, you know, sommelier nerd out wines.
Right. So it's an exposure to a lot of different types
of trends. Yeah, so it's kind of like some of the weird stuff that's cool and fun right now.
We're going to have to wrap up soon, but David, my engineer, is giving me the high sign. But David, don't forget, before we go off the air, we have to taste some wines. We're going to get that in quickly, okay? anything else besides Somm's Corner? I mean, you do education there.
Yeah, we have a great area in the back where we host tastings and events, and that's great. And anybody that's interested in that, just, you know, visit.
So let's give everyone the vitals here. So the store is Verve Wine.
Store is Verve Wine.
It's Tribeca, and the address is
24 Hubert Street,
which is between what and what?
It's on basically Greenwich, between Greenwich and the West Side Highway.
All right, and I've been on the site a bunch of times, and it's a terrific site. It's very visual, very informative. What's the web address?
It's vervewine.com.
So it's V-E-R-V, wine, one word.
Check that out. There's a place to sign up for the email list. I would recommend that. Follow us on social. We do a lot of, like, fun, educational stuff on social. You know, we're trying to do all these things that I, you know, jabber on about.
And by the way, there's a good chance during the week, mid-afternoon, you have some serious wine needs and inquiries. You call them, and guess who picks up the phone? You know, so Dustin is not going anywhere most of the day, most of the week.
Yeah, I'll be there.
All right, so that's Verve Wine in New York City. It's definitely an exciting, terrific place. All right, we're going to wrap the show up quickly, David. We're going to do our weekly wine sip. Every week we taste a different wine on air. For our weekly wine sip this week, we're going to taste, I brought the exact opposite wine of what everyone drinks and thinks. We're going to taste a 2012 Trevaro del Sala from Umbria. So it's an Umbrian wine. It's made by Antinori. It is a blend of 85% Chardonnay, 15% Grechetto. Did I pronounce that right?
Grechetto, yeah.
Grechetto. This wine and current vintages retail for between $39-$49. Not a cheap wine, not the most expensive. And it's available at better wine stores. So, Trouty, will you pour this around for everybody? We're going to do a quick taste, quick assessment, and we're going to wrap up. David, our engineer, who's mad at me, but once the wine comes out, I know, we're running long. All right, so let's talk about this wine. Dustin, can you tell me anything else about this wine? You know anything about it?
This is my first time trying this wine.
Okay, so that's kind of why I brought it in. I didn't want to, like, what would Dustin be drinking? All right, so it's Antinori. It's predominantly Chardonnay, so it'll probably be big. Let's look at color first. You know, typical Chardonnay.
Yeah, it's got a nice kind of golden hue to it.
All right, now give me your nose on this.
Pretty, like, ripe, baked apple, little apricot. Like some dried fruit here, too.
Does that tip you off that this is going to be like this big, fruity Chardonnay or
it
not
smells,
necessarily?
It smells rich and round. Okay. I know you can't really necessarily tell that, but it does smell that way.
All right.
It's got some perfume. You can smell the, you know, some nice toasty wood on there.
All right, let's give it a sip.
It's got a little of that lactic-y thing that you get from malolactic.
Let's throw it over the tongue.
All right.
Mouthfeel, medium.
Rich, compelling.
Rich mouthfeel? Mouthfeel. Like glycerine-y,
full rich. Yeah, full rich.
All right, now let's
get... It's got some nice acidity, though, too. It's not just a big, oily, mouth coater. It's got some acid there, too.
I definitely get the acidity.
Yeah.
Which you're right, because it's a round wine, but that acidity cuts through.
Right.
All right, give me some palate descriptors.
Palate descriptors? I mean, I think that creamy, rich, round, textured...
Which fruit?
Impression. Again, baked apple. Baked like red apple. Baked pear, like a caramelized pear. A little bit of a burnt kind of creme brulee kind of feel to it. A little vanilla cinnamon from the oak toast.
A lot of the classic descriptors.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
is this wine Burgundian at all for an Umbrian wine or not really?
For me, this feels something more in between, like a California wine. The nose reminds me more of California.
Right.
The palate is a little fresher, so you can kind of tell it's an old world wine there.
Tell me a good wine and food pairing for this. Good food pairing.
Oh, man. I would get maybe like a lobster roll or something.
That's a good one.
It's getting warm outside.
I'd drink a Pepsi with a lobster roll. Doesn't matter. Actually, four lobster rolls and a Pepsi. All right. So do we like this wine?
Yeah, I think it's very high quality. It's not personally like my
style
but I
but
think
it's made well.
It's well made. It's typical for its grape and its place.
Does the Grochetto add anything to it?
You know, I'm not really. Maybe that's where some of the freshness and the acidity is coming from.
Could be that.
Aromatically, I'm not picking up. But Grochetto is also a relatively neutral variety on the nose.
Is this wine worth the money, or is that a little high? $40. 37.
It tastes, I would say, if it was closer to right around the $40 range, I think this is a solid $40 bottle.
Under 40.
Yeah,
okay.
If it's
so
creeping
it
up to 50,
quality.
That's the,
no.
Then I don't think so.
All right, so that was the 2012 Trevaro della Sala from Umbria. It's by Antinori. It's basically Antinori's signature white wine. All right, I want to thank our guest, Dustin Wilson. He told you who he is. He's now over at Verve Wine.
Come see me.
Come see him. Go online. Call. If you have a question, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation. Follow us on Facebook. We're /thegrapenation. Instagram, S Ben Ruby. Twitter, Ben Ruby without the S. Thanks again to Dustin. Thank you to our engineer, our very patient engineer, David Tadashore.
Yeah, likewise, I'm also pretty active on social, so if anybody wants to hit me
we'll
up on social, that's fine too.
thank you to everyone at Heritage Radio. Dustin, you could reach on Instagram.
Yep.
At Dustin Wilson MS.
Correct.
At Verve Wine.
Correct.
On Instagram. On Twitter. Dustin Wilson MS.
Same too. At Verve Wine or at Dustin Wilson MS.
And is there any Facebook play?
I'm not really personally a Facebook guy, but Verve does have a Facebook account. We would love it if you liked us on Facebook.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's all the stuff. Definitely, you people in New York City, get down there. If you're visiting, get down there. And if you're out of town, enjoy the experience online and try to hook up with Dustin. Thank you for joining us. Thank you to everyone at Heritage Radio. I'm Sam Ben Ruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.